Straight talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
Well, today on the show, we're going to be having a professor talk about the safety and effectiveness of, it's not what you think, the safety and effectiveness of, you know what, I can't say it. Can I say it? Will I be banned? Will I be censored? We're going to be talking about the safety and effectiveness of HCQ, of hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin, zinc, vitamins D, vitamin C, taking these things in order to boost your immune system. Remember, the doctors can give you all the medicine in the world, but if your immune system is kaput, then you are kaput. It's our immune system that fights everything. The drugs and medicines and herbs or whatever type of treatment you're taking is only there in order to assist your immune system. Now, for anybody who might be wondering, why is Tamar Yonah doing so many shows on the quote-unquote mRNA injection and the coronavirus? And I want to be straightforward with you and tell you that, unfortunately, the main news, the big news conglomerates are all touting, get the vaccine, get the vaccine. It's safe and effective. But you know, if you think about it, just think for 1 minute, how do they know it's safe? There is not enough data. There is not enough time. Now, saying that, maybe it is safe. The point is, we don't know yet. We will find out. Maybe it is safe, but maybe it's not safe. Now, so far, I've been having people coming on the show talking about some of the terrible adverse effects that they've had because there is a safety risk to this. Even if the majority of the people today seem like they're okay, that is a good sign, but only time will tell. It's still too early to know. So I want to give you the other side, the side that you're not hearing, so you can make an informed decision. So you're going to hear the great things about the safety and effectiveness, and it's not even effective, the vaccine we're finding out as time goes by. You're hearing all of that from everyone else, but how much are you hearing from the other side? I'm here to present that to you. We'll be right back.
The return of the Jewish people to the land of Israel was prophesied in the Bible thousands of years ago and is coming true today. Shalom. Join me, Josh Wander, on Israel Unplugged. Listen in as we delve into the spiritual and physical aspects of the Jewish return to Zion. We'll discuss the biblically mandated, historic, and of course practical understandings of this incredible transition from exile to redemption. That's Israel Unplugged, every Monday on IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com.
All right, we are back here at the Tamar Yonah Show on IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com, and we're going to find out now more about the experimental mRNA shot, what we're not being told about the COVID-19 vaccine. I mean, would you buy an imported car from the manufacturer when they refuse to give you a guarantee for its safety? That's what we're seeing with this vaccine. The pharmaceutical companies and even the government that is mandating these vaccines in many cases are not taking any responsibility. You're on your own. So it's for your benefit that you study and you find out as much information and data as you can about this experimental mRNA vaccine that they're putting out. Many doctors say it's not even a vaccine, so I'll call it an injection. But I want to introduce our guest. He is Dr. Harvey Riesch. He's a professor of epidemiology at the Yale School of Public Health. After receiving his medical degree, Dr. Riesch received a PhD in mathematical modeling of infectious epidemics, and then worked over his long career doing large studies of risk factors for cancer, including medications, infections, and other causes. 18 months ago, he was appointed the Connecticut Academy of Science and Engineering COVID Committee for reopening of the state when he started working on prevention and treatment of COVID. In May 2020, Dr. Risch published the seminal paper demonstrating the safety and effectiveness of hydroxychloroquine in early outpatient treatment of high-risk COVID patients. COVID-19 infection is highly treatable if treatment is started within the first 4 to 5 days of symptoms, he says. So I want to welcome to the show Dr. Harvey Risch.
A pleasure to be with you.
So let's jump right into it. We have had a so-called pandemic of the coronavirus. We saw frightening videos of people dropping dead in the street, wrapped up bodies lying on the sidewalk or in hospital wards waiting to be taken for burial, medical workers sitting on the hospital floor from exhaustion and screaming. I remember those videos. And they were screaming from the overwhelming workload that they had, the death count. And then we saw medical workers in hazmat suits walking around. And then we were fed a daily death toll announced on the news every single day. I don't remember that for any other disease or illness people suffer from. We were fed a dose of tragic families parting from dying loved ones behind hospital glass. And on top of that, we had lockdowns around the world, adding to the eerie feeling and the fear that we were all experiencing. Then you and a few other doctors finally were able to come up with an effective treatment to pull the vast majority of people who got COVID back to health. But you were silenced, you were called quacks, you risked your credibility, and even possibly you risked your license to continue to practice medicine. So my question to you is, why has the government and medical establishment rejected this cheap and effective treatment?
Well, it's an economic question, and you have to realize the magnitude of the economic forces that are at play across the world and how those bear on the marketplace. And what that means is, if a large company worth trillions has the resources to alter the economic playing field in its favor, it will do that. And the generic medications that I and others, other doctors, have been investigating don't have anybody to speak for them. There's no large manufacturer doing randomized trials for new diseases for those generic medications. So you have pipsqueak people like me versus, multi-trillion dollar corporations, and guess who gets most of the media attention? And that's why the playing field is tilted to suppress the things that would work really well if they had half a chance. And in fact, they did have half a chance. In Israel, in fact, in the first few months of the pandemic, Israeli doctors were actually using hydroxychloroquine in early outpatient treatment successfully. And then suddenly, when the FDA started putting up its fraudulent website warnings, and the fraudulent paper came out in The Lancet and the New England Journal about the fake Surgisphere data, people freaked out, and everybody suddenly got amnesia about what they had been doing. And so it's not just that general people in the population have been terrorized by all of this, but doctors have been equally terrorized in their careers by all of this.
So I'm going to ask you about that a little bit later in the show, but basically, if I understand what you're saying, that the governments around the world are in bed together with the pharmaceutical companies that are manufacturing these mRNA injections?
I don't think it's actually exactly in bed. I think they're bullied by them. I think the pharmaceutical companies and other gigantic industrialists, there's a history of this going back 100 years, that they have such large capabilities and resources that they have the ability to bully certain countries. And we know this for a fact in South America, that Brazil discussed this publicly, that the vaccine manufacturer, before it would sell the vaccine to Brazil, insisted on title to national assets like airports and military bases. Now, the vaccine company was saying, we don't know if you're going to be able to pay what we're charging you for the vaccines. But on the other hand, Brazil is a country with 220 million people, and it wants to get all the other drugs that it gets from these companies, and it's unlikely to default, thinking that it's not going to pay one when it might need more in the future, it needs other drugs and so on. So to me, that explanation doesn't hold water. What I see is these companies are so large and powerful that they have enormous sway on governments, not just that the governments are going along with it.
So I want to understand this. Were you saying that the pharmaceutical companies were twisting the arms of government, saying that if you don't fall into this program and buy our vaccines, that then we're not going to sell you other medications that your people need, like insulin, antibiotics, all those other things?
I have no direct information to that. I hypothesize that that's the case based on the behaviors that I've observed.
Wow. I have not heard that before. That is very interesting. And so are there, you know, we know that there have been government employees at very high rank who have received treatment for COVID when they got it of hydroxychloroquine and zinc or ivermectin. And you would think, one would think, that if they had any conscious at all, that they would say to the other people, this can save your life, even though they know that, you know, there are repercussions to it. And yet we don't hear people speaking out. Once U.S. President Donald Trump spoke about it, they had his head on a platter. But what about the other people?
Well, in fact, this story started well before President Trump actually said anything. It started in November of 2019, when the Minister of Health of France made hydroxychloroquine, it was originally over-the-counter, and they converted it to prescription only, with a fake charge of potential harm in usage, even though hydroxychloroquine has been used in tens of billions of doses by hundreds of millions of people for more than 50 years. It's among the very safest drugs on the planet. It's used by pregnant women, you know, children, frail elderly. Everybody can use it. There are very few contraindications. There are a few, but very few, to using hydroxychloroquine. And so it's known to be safe, and there's no reason why it should have been converted from over-the-counter to prescription only, except for the fact that there was already afoot a plan to undermine the playing field at that point in late 2019. In February of 2020, this is still before President Trump said anything, a paper appeared in the New England Journal written by four British people who do clinical trials for a living, saying that only randomized trials are valid and that all what they called real-world evidence, meaning my entire field of epidemiology, is worthless. It was an entire screed against my field and my discipline. And this paper was packed with lies, falsehoods, and misrepresentations that only a very credulous, naive person could take at face value. An ignorant person in terms of medical research would take at face value. And these people were all funded by drug companies, and this appeared at a time, again, to set the playing field such that only randomized trial evidence would be available to be used in support of approvals for treating COVID. Before we hardly even knew that there was a COVID pandemic, they knew. This was known. These people knew this in late 2019 and early 2020, well before Donald Trump ever said anything.
Today, if a doctor prescribes ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine for their patient for treating COVID, they are their prescriptions are not even respected. They can't even be filled by the pharmacies. Has that ever happened before?
No, I mean, I think this depends on the jurisdiction. For example, the state of Nebraska, on Friday, the Attorney General wrote a long, detailed report saying that doctors are free to use hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin.
You know what, doctor? Can you hold on 1 second? We have to go to a break. We're going to be right back. Don't go anywhere.
Hi, I'm Steve Miller.
And I'm Matt Zucker.
Join us for Lighten Up, where we take a look at the week's current events in Israel and from around the Jewish world through a humorous lens.
If you've been paying attention during these crazy times, you know that it's a challenge to parody life anymore. But join Steve and I as we give it the old college try. Not only is being happy an obligation, but life is just too short to take it all so seriously.
So join me, Steve Miller.
And me, Matt Zucker.
For Lighten Up every Monday morning at 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, 5 p.m. Israel, only on IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com.
All right, we are back here at the Tamar Yonah Show on IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com, and our guest is Dr. Harvey Risch. He is a professor of epidemiology at Yale School of Public Health, and he's here talking to us about the mRNA shot and about treatment for COVID, with so many COVID deaths that we're constantly hearing about on the television, in the news. I want to say this. When people come to me and say, but Tamar, so many people are dying of COVID. And I say to them, because they're not getting any treatment for it. If you had pneumonia and you didn't get treatment for it, you would probably die too. So we know that there's treatment. It is proven. Our guest, Dr. Harvey Risch, I believe, has testified in front of the Senate, a Senate committee.
Yes. Yes.
Tell us briefly about that.
Senator Johnson, who is a very bright light in the U.S. Senate, who sticks to his principles of what he thinks is right without political influence, as far as I can tell, has asked a number of questions of the National Institutes of Health and the FDA and the CDC as to why the government has not funded any research, any trials on generic medications for COVID. It's, when he did this, we testified in November of 2020, it had been almost a year since this had been going on, and there was nothing to show for it that the government had funded. And this was a big lapse, and obviously there was a purpose in that lapse, because everything that you hear and see that's come out of our government agencies has been in the direction of pushing either patented medications or vaccines. And those all have very large financial implications, as opposed to generic medications, which they go out of their way to suppress with fake evidence, with innuendo, with smears, with misrepresentations. Our federal agencies have been doing that. The most egregious one that's still visible on the FDA's website, there's a warning about using hydroxychloroquine in outpatients, and it has big black letters saying, warning, do not use hydroxychloroquine in outpatients. Underneath that, it says, we base this warning on adverse events that we've observed in hospitalized patients. And that's a fraud, because hospitalized patients is pneumonia. Outpatient is like a flu-like viral illness. They're treated differently. They're totally different diseases. Just because one starts as COVID and the other one becomes pneumonia doesn't mean they're the same. And you cannot extrapolate from one to the other. That's medical malpractice. So that's a fraud. It's still there more than a year later. And that's what poisoned the atmosphere for doctors thinking that they could use hydroxychloroquine to treat, when the FDA is saying, warning, you shouldn't do it.
Wow. So in the last segment, I was asking you about prescriptions that doctors write. I was asking you if this is the first time ever that if a doctor prescribes you something that the pharmacy will say no?
To my knowledge, this is the first organized plan to do that, to put that in force. The rationales that have been given by pharmacies and pharmacy chains have been spurious, saying they didn't have enough medication for the people who take hydroxychloroquine regularly, people with rheumatoid arthritis, and lupus, and other autoimmune diseases who take hydroxychloroquine daily. They made these astonishing claims that are totally absurd, because we had 60 million doses in the strategic national stockpile in the U.S. that we were trying to deliver at the times that the pharmacies were saying they didn't have enough to go around, so to speak. These were messages that were prepackaged widely across many of the states that came from, you know, the forces that were controlling this whole process.
I want to ask you if you can share with our listeners what it's like to be a doctor behind the scenes. How is it that, do you have to listen to, if you're working in a hospital, you have to listen to the director of the hospital, or if you're in your own private practice, who are you taking orders from, the medical establishment? How does it work?
Well, first I'll say that I'm not in clinical practice. I've been doing research medicine after medical school, so I can only tell you what I perceive from my colleagues. I think, however, there is a large feeling of chain of command based on medical society's position statements, and now we have circumstance where science is totally out the window in medicine for a couple of reasons. The main problem is everybody wants to feel that what they do is defensible, and so they point to somebody above them, some official agency, when they want to defend what their practice is. That means if they go against the CDC or the FDA or something, and some event were to happen, they have nobody to point to and say, just following orders.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where medicine has devolved to. Secondly, journal publishing is now totally corrupt. And the reason medical publishing, and the reason for that is that many medical journals are supported by pharma company advertising. So the editors in chief of the journals are paid positions. Their salaries are created by advertising by the drug companies in the journals. And so the journals are highly afloat because of the medical advertising for the drug companies. So the journals cannot go against the interests of the drug companies, and the drug companies have weighed in very heavily about things they don't want to see in journals. And I myself am and have been an editor of three medical scientific journals, and have felt pressure, as has the editors of the New England Journal, the Lancet, and so on, who've spoken publicly about the pressure coming from drug companies. I've seen papers pulled by publishers after they were approved by the editor and the reviewers because the publisher was afraid of drug companies pushing back on advertising in the journals. So there is a huge corruption. It's not new for this year. It's been for at least 30 or 40 years that the amount, and don't forget, those drug companies advertise on television, in newspapers, and so the income from those ads forces those media to have to toe the interests of the drug companies to do the advertising. So the whole system is interrelated and corrupted, and that's what makes it very difficult to get objective information in medical papers out into the literature, and so the public can read them.
This is so enlightening. So besides pulling away their advertising account from a medical journal, do the pharmaceutical companies have any other muscle that they can use in order to convince you to toe the line?
Oh, yes. Every major academic medical center has professors in medicine paid as consultants for pharma companies. I've done consulting for pharma companies, not in the last few years, but I have, and most academic physicians have at one time or another, and many, you know, more recently. Don't forget that when a large drug company develops a new medication, it may spend $1 billion for the research, but it probably spends $2 billion on the advertising and control, and that means all the consultants that they basically pay off to keep their mouth shut to go along with what the pharma company wants to say. And this is so widespread, you know, you can look up people's pharma payments on online sources. The U.S. federal government has a database of doctors who've been paid consulting and lecturing fees by drug companies. There's Dollars for Docs, which is ProPublica, that has a website for that. I believe there's another one in Europe. And so you can see, you can take a paper in the medical literature and look up the authors in these databases to see who's been receiving pharma payments to know what their conflicts of interest are.
Wow. So tell me, so a doctor who is sitting in his office, he sees patients, he prescribes them drugs. I understand that there are drug representatives coming to doctors off hours or whatever and talking to them and saying, listen, if you suggest our drug to your patients instead of, let's say, another company's, you know, you're going to get points for vacations. Or, I mean, is that true? How does that work, if so?
I don't think it's that overt. I think that the lobbyists come, they provide free samples for the physicians to give to their patients. They provide literature. The literature is selected to show the benefit of the product that's being distributed. I think that's basically fair, but I think doctors feel like they don't have time to read the literature, and so they depend on these drug reps to inform them about new and useful medications. And look, if a medication is useful and safe, there's every reason to put it into practice, and doctors need to find out about it and to help improve their practices. So the research is important, and the knowledge base is important. It's only when that knowledge base is used to strangle something, you know, a competitor that can't support it, can't defend itself, that you have a problem.
So you're saying that doctors don't get any perks for prescribing drugs?
I honestly don't know. I mean, when I was in medical school, we got free stethoscopes, and we thought about rejecting them because we already didn't want to be feeling like we were beholden to drug companies. So I'm sure that happens, but I don't know the extent of it and whether it's really meaningful amounts in terms of what doctors take in, you know, for their incomes.
Interesting. And so I understand that some of the tests that these pharmaceutical companies run when they have a new drug out or a vaccine, et cetera, that let's say that they'll do like an 18-month study to see afterwards if there's any adverse effects. And if they have something that's an unacceptable high number for the drug that they're trying to push out or the vaccine, that they'll say, you know what, how many people, let's say after 18 months, I don't know, I'll just throw out some numbers. 10,000 people, which is above what the limit is, we're pretending here, of people who had adverse effects is an unacceptable number. So they'll say, you know what? How many people complained of these effects after 12 months instead of 18 months? And then the research will say, well, nobody yet, because the symptoms didn't show up until, let's say, 15 months later. So they'll say, so then let's stop the research at 12 months and say it's safe and effective. I understand that this is what pharmaceutical companies might do, but we have to go. We'll be right back, everybody. Don't go anywhere.
Are you tired of political correctness and the fear that you might offend someone?
I'm not afraid to offend you.
Wow, look who's talking tough.
One has to be tough to keep sane today.
Hi, I'm Alan Skorsky.
And I'm Bayla Seabrow.
And join us every Wednesday for The Definitive Wrap as we interview the most sought-after guests and expose progressive trends that masquerade as enlightenment but actually destroy our freedoms.
We are the No Woke Zone, so buckle up to this exciting show.
Buckling up, but I'm driving.
Sure, you can drive, but I'm the navigator.
Tune in for the No Nonsense, The Definitive Wrap Show, every Wednesday on Israel News Talk Radio.
All right, we are back here at the Tamar Yonah Show on IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com. And our guest today is Dr. Harvey Risch. He is a professor of epidemiology at Yale School of Public Health. And he's here talking to us about safe and effective ways to be able to treat COVID if, God forbid, somebody in your family or you come down with it. And that you don't have to automatically jump to an untested enough experimental vaccine. And we're starting to see, as time goes on, more and more data is coming in about the dangers and the adverse effects that people are getting, including strokes and heart attacks, blood clots, death also, unfortunately, and so many other symptoms. In the last segment, Dr. Risch, I was asking you about how pharmaceutical companies can how they have tricks up their sleeves, how they can change the impression of the safety of a drug or a vaccine that they put out. Can you share with us a little bit on that?
So all of these randomized trials that drug companies and academic medical researchers do for medications are registered with the website of the U.S. government. And that registration has to spell out in minute detail exactly how long the trial is going to go and what the outcome is, who are the patients, what the medications are, how they're given, how the data are going to be analyzed. Everything has got to be spelled out in advance. So in theory, there can't be any messing around. However, that's not how it works out in practice, and that's because there are still ways of designing a study that allow you to change things that go on. For example, the randomized trials of hydroxychloroquine changed the outcome of interest in the middle of the study, or they designed the study for a much larger benefit than they found, and so they said, oh, well, the study is too small to see that benefit, we'll quit in the middle, when, of course, they didn't have enough people to be able to see anything at all, and so on. So there are tricks that can be used to make studies come out with null results. And your question about could they stop a study at 12 months knowing that at 18 months the results weren't good, it wouldn't be very smart to do that, because what that means is when the drug gets approved or the vaccine gets approved and it's out in the field and millions of people are taking it, those things are going to happen again and it's going to come out. And then somebody will get a Freedom of Information Act and find out that the original study did go longer and did show that and so on, and that would provide some legal issues. So drug companies and pharma companies, vaccine companies are not going to do that. They have other ways to do it, but that's not one of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they can try to avoid testing in animals, or they don't go long enough because they decide originally that they're not going to go long enough, and the trials get approved that way. So there are ways of doing these kinds of things, and we can see some of them, but not all of them.
Well, so it's hard to believe anybody.
Yeah, I know. And, you know, it's funny. My wife has been asking me for 40 years, when you read a scientific paper, how do you know if it's valid or not? And I've always told her, you have to know the people who did the study. You can't tell by reading the study. You can only guess from reading the study. You have to know the people.
Fascinating. So what can you tell us about doctors who want to help their patients? Let's say that a doctor is convinced because he's had too many patients coming in with adverse effects from the vaccine. He wants to warn his patients, maybe you should wait. I've heard that there is effective treatment for it. You don't have to be so afraid. We don't hear doctors doing that. Doctors are just towing the line. This is the standard procedure. Yes, go out and get the vaccine. It's safe and effective, which is a lie. We know it's not safe now after all this time, and it's not been very much time. And
I don't think I would say that exactly.
Okay.
I think the
Why?
Vaccine is relatively safe. It's just that there's a large number of adverse events that occur because a huge number of people have taken it. Now, I wouldn't want to be an adverse event to have, you know, have been forced into taking it and then find something horrible happen. And the numbers of adverse events have been way larger than flu vaccines and other vaccines in the past. So we do have a big problem. But there are many people who actually have been saved, people who are at high risk, who had to choose between, you know, taking their life in their hands if they had gotten COVID and maybe taking a vaccine that might not be perfectly safe, but, you know, it's a rational choice to try to consider both options. For the great rest of the population, it's not really a rational choice because they are much more likely to get over the COVID with an unpleasant bout of a flu-like illness, and or less even, because 80% of COVID is asymptomatic. People don't even know they've had it.
My point I'm trying to get across here is that to say as we say in Hebrew, to say and emphasize that it is safe, because not enough time has gone by to know that yet. To say that it's safe is not true yet. Maybe it is. Maybe you're right. Maybe it is, but we cannot know yet. And effectively, yep. We know that the vaccine has failed. We know that if you get the vaccine, you can still get COVID. And if you get the vaccine, you can still pass it on to others. So it's neither, at this point in history, safe nor effective.
Well, I wouldn't. You see, I think it's a mistake to make it into all or nothing. I think that it's moderately safe, but not completely. It's moderately beneficial, but not completely. It does seem to reduce transmission. There's no other explanation for why the number of cases in Israel has declined over the last 3 or 4 weeks so dramatically, other than the boosters. So it is doing something, but it's leaky. It's not perfect, and there's a lot that still gets out. Vaccinated people can indeed spread the infection to other vaccinated people, if not unvaccinated people. Does it happen day in, day out? Probably not so much, but it can still happen. And there's no point in mandating it, in my opinion, and there's no point of being afraid of each other, that it's a treatable disease, as I said, and even vaccinated people who get it can be treated if necessary. So I think the fear factor is huge in this. Doctors are, as I said, are just as afraid as everybody else, and they're afraid to be able to, you know, stick out and do on their own. But I have to tell you that there are 4 or 5 telemedicine groups in the United States that are treating COVID patients, half a dozen doctors' clinics, large clinics that have been treating them, a lot of other doctors that I know who have been treating COVID patients, and I've queried them, I surveyed them periodically for how many people they've treated, and my total now at the moment is over the last year and a half, they treated more than 150,000 Americans, and the number of lives lost out of that is maybe less than 24. That's the bottom line. It's an open secret.
Can you say a word? We only have about 3 minutes left. Just a word about vaccine shedding. What exactly is that? Is it true?
Yes, it is. Whether it's a big issue or not is unknown. The manufacturers have described it in their protocols and instructions for use and information for doctors and so on. So it does exist. It's hard to know how meaningful and important it is medically. So that's not, to me, the big issues. The big issues are the vaccines are moderately beneficial, especially when used in the subset of the population that has a risk-benefit trade-off to consider. They should not be mandated, because what is going to get us out of this pandemic is natural immunity, not vaccine immunity. Vaccine immunity does not cover enough variants in the mutant strains of the COVID. It doesn't last long enough, and it doesn't stay strong enough. So it works for a while, but not long enough, whereas once you've gotten COVID, you have a very strong, lasting immunity, and that is what's going to get us out. In the United States, I estimate we have about 70% of the population has had COVID. That's why we're going to be doing better once the Delta wave is down. In Israel, it's much lower because of the lockdowns and the resorting to vaccine only. So the way to get out of this is for young people who are healthy to get COVID, get through it, have lifelong or very long-lasting immunity that will protect them from future mutant strains, and mm-hmm. that's how the best way we can do it.
Hmm. There's so much more I want to talk to you about, but we only have another minute or so. I understand now that autoimmune disease is now the largest growing disease in the United States. Do you know anything about that?
That's not my specialty. You might be right. I don't know. I know it's common.
So, some doctors are saying, they're releasing on videos, they're talking about this, and they're saying that they believe that it's from the vaccine, that it is hurting the immune system of people, the mRNA technology that they're using in this shot, and that it's hurting them. And they're even saying that people who have gotten vaccinated would be wise to stay indoors and quarantine themselves this winter, because these doctors believe that their immune systems have been so damaged from these two or three shots that they are going to be very susceptible to anything out there. They'll be almost like AIDS patients, in fact,
Well, we know that over the 2 weeks after each shot, the immune system, the lymphocytes, are depressed for a week to 10 days, up to 2 weeks after each shot, and people are more susceptible to getting COVID and other respiratory infections. And there should have been notice that everybody, when they get vaccinated, should quarantine for a week or 10 days. That would lower the number of cases dramatically.
Huh.
But it's not a huge thing, and by 2 weeks, then the benefit of the vaccines comes about for the next 3 to 5 months.
This is fascinating speaking with you. I hope to have you back on again so we can look more into the subject. Dr. Harvey Risch can be found, if you want to go to their website, at www.earlycovidcare.org. Again, that's earlycovidcare.org. We will link to his website on the page where the show is podcasted, so you can just click it and be right there. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Professor. It has been an honor to have you on and very enlightening.
My pleasure. Happy to come back at some point if you like.
Thank you. And thank you all for listening.
If you love Israel News Talk Radio, then you'll love our Facebook page. We keep you up to date on what's happening in Israel, plus little surprise treasures that we don't share on the radio. Go now to follow us on Facebook. Just look for the Israel News Talk Radio Facebook page, and don't forget to subscribe and follow us by clicking on the like button. We post great stuff there that you'll want to share. Israel News Talk Radio on Facebook and Israel News Radio on Twitter.
If you're hearing this message, everyone else can too. Advertise with Israel News Talk Radio and get your message out to people. We'll build a personalized package for you. Contact advertising at israelnewstalkradio.com.
Straight talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
Hey, this is Jake in Anchorage, Alaska, and I love listening to all the super interesting interviews and up-to-date information on what's happening in Israel.
Hello, this is Anna King, originally from London, now living in Israel. And what can I say? Israel News Talk Radio is my cup of tea.
My name is Bhaskar. I'm from India, and I love listening because you get to know the truth and wonderful voices from this lovely country.
Mom! Okay, wait a minute.
Hi, this is Chava Dax, and I'm calling for the rolling hills of Maale Adumim, just north of Jerusalem. I always listen to Israel News Talk Radio to get all the latest news and commentary and to keep me up to date every day.
This is Sarah Dax from Maale Adumim, and I'm 12. I wish Israel News Talk Radio was boring so my mom wouldn't listen to it all the time. Mom!
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
News, opinion, and more.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.